Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How does the federal government come up with the trillions of dollars it spends every year? And what does all that money buy us anyway? U.S. government spending added up to about a quarter of our gross domestic product in fiscal year 2011, as compared with a little over 4% when FDR took office in 1932. So how did the government get so big, and what would it take to bring our spending and revenue back in line? David Wessel is here to explain all that for us. He is economics editor for the Wall Street Journal and author of the new book Red Ink, Inside the High Stakes Politics of the Federal Budget. David, welcome back to Think.
You're welcome.
So,
good to be here.
Last year, the federal government spent $400 million every hour. Does anybody disagree that that is unsustainable?
No. Pretty much, we're in the post-denial phase of the discussion of the deficit. There's some argument about the timing of when we have to do something about it, but no one thinks the current pace of spending, particularly projected in the future, is sustainable.
And it's not simply the problem of spending, it's the problem of how much we are borrowing.
Correct. Mm-hmm. We could raise taxes and cover our spending, and that would be one way to reduce the deficit. It would probably require much higher taxes than the American people are willing to stomach, and probably wouldn't be good for our economy. One of the reasons this is so dangerous is that we've been lulled into, I think, a sense of false security, because we've been able to borrow so much money, almost unlimited amounts, at record low interest rates. And as long as that goes on, it's fine. The problem is it's not going to go on forever, and it would be better to deal with it in advance so we don't find ourselves strangled at some point because the federal debt is so heavy and the annual interest payments are choking off other spending.
What is the breakdown of federal debt held by U.S. investors versus other governments and foreign investors?
Roughly half the debt is held by foreigners now, and half of that is held by the Chinese. It's really remarkable of how much that's changed over the years. 30 or 40 years ago, China was an insignificant player. Now they are basically our biggest creditor.
And as you point out here, the Chinese per capita income is something like one-sixth of the U.S.
Right. So what happens is the Chinese save a lot of money, and they can't use it all in their country, which is pretty incredible given how poor some parts of China are. And they're trying to keep their currency from rising, so they do a lot of intervention in the currency markets. They end up with a lot of dollars. They end up with a lot of dollars because they sell us more than we sell them. You have to do something with these dollars. They lend them back to us. We're on the other side of that problem. We don't save enough as a nation when you add up the businesses, governments, and individuals. And there are so many investment opportunities in the United States that other people would rather have their money here than at home. And that's created a kind of major imbalance in the world economy that it's going to cause a problem someday.
So let's talk about how government spending got to be so unwieldy. Today, government spending is about 24.1% of GDP, close to six times what it was in the early 30s, and that was when the New Deal set us on course for higher spending that never fully reversed itself.
Right. Basically, we have a pattern here of the government spends more, either because we're fighting a war or because we have a terribly weak economy. That emergency ends, but spending never goes back to where it was before. Just a simple example, Medicare and Medicaid, the two federal health programs, Medicare for the elderly, Medicaid for the poor, they cost more today, adjusted for inflation, than the entire federal government cost in 1960.
Let's talk about the difference, before we get into the other details of this, between mandatory spending and discretionary spending.
Right. Well, those are kind of Washington jargon terms. So what it means is this. Every year, Congress shows up, and it, because of promises it's made in the past, about 63% of the spending is already committed. It's Medicare, Social Security, farm subsidies, veterans payments, interest on the debt. It's all committed. And they spend the rest of the year trying to figure out how much to spend on that other third. The first part is called mandatory because the government has obligated itself to make the payments. If you're eligible for Medicare and Social Security, you get it. The other part is called discretionary because it requires an annual act of Congress to spend the money. And that's much of what people think the government is. It's the Pentagon budget. It's the people who work at the national parks. It's the salaries for the bureaucrats who answer the phone at NASA and so forth.
And we do have the ability, Congress does have the ability to change its obligations for mandatory spending, but it would take a great deal of action on their part.
Well, Congress from time to time does tweak the mandatory spending, the benefit programs. It's just that the system doesn't force them to do it, and particularly in election years, which, as you know, is pretty much every second year, they're inclined not to touch them. And so it's on autopilot, and the problem is healthcare spending is rising so fast that it's on autopilot at a pace which is unsustainable.
I was astonished to read that half the amount of healthcare spending in this country is paid for by government programs of one kind or another.
Right. Over the last decade or so, more and more people have gone on government-supported health insurance. That's because either they lost their job or their employer stopped offering it, so they turned to the government, or because of deliberate government policies to provide people with, for instance, more Medicaid. And that the share will increase over time under the president's health care law, if it survives the Republican attempts to repeal it. And it's kind of one of the dark secrets that we don't have a government-run health care system, but we have a health care system where the government is now picking up almost half the cost.
Would it be cheaper if the government were running healthcare? Is there any way to really know that for sure?
There is no way to know that for sure. There are certainly people who argue that, and they say, look, we spend all our time trying to figure out what insurance covers, and it's all this inefficiency, and if we had a single-payer system, it would be cleaner, and we could control it and we'd spend less money. Other people look at the thing and say, look, the government is going to have a hard time ever saying no to anybody who wants health care. And the only way we're going to save our health care system is to set up some competition to make it so that different providers of health care are forced to be efficient, because if not, they'll cost more than the other guy and people will switch to the other guy. There are arguments on both sides. I do think that if the Obama health law doesn't work, if we end up with ever-rising health care costs, eventually we're going to be forced into a system where the government runs the show, because that'll be the only way to put a cap on spending.
So let's talk about Social Security. You have a remarkable little graph in the book, and it shows that in 1950, there were 16.5 taxpaying workers for every person who was receiving Social Security benefits. As of 2010, there were 2.9, and by 2040, there will be 2.1 workers for every person drawing benefits.
Right. That's basically the consequence of the baby boom. Social Security was in great shape when the baby boom was all working, and there were more baby boomers than there were retirees. But the oldest of the baby boomers are now 65, and every year more and more of them will reach the eligibility age for Social Security. And the system wasn't really set up to have the pyramid turned upside down. This is a problem in other countries, too. It's a more acute problem in countries like Italy, where the population is shrinking, or in Japan. It will someday be a problem in China, because they also have a big generation that's getting close to retirement. And it's one of those fundamental facts of demographics that we can't escape. We have to decide what to do about it, but we can't escape it.
There are some people, David, who say even if we are replacing our population by birth at a smaller rate than we were in the past, that if we open the doors wide to immigration, we could at least ameliorate the problem with Social Security. Do you think that's accurate?
Well, it's true that if you bring in a lot of taxpaying immigrants who are working age, that makes Social Security's problems better or less acute. The government actuaries who do these things actually have numbers about this. I don't know them off the top of the head, I'm sorry. But in Canada, for instance, they have encouraged immigration with that in mind. As you know, immigration is really not an issue that's decided on the economics. Immigration is an issue that goes to people's sense of identity, their concerns about whether people who look like them are being outnumbered, about American culture being changed, and it's a very emotional issue, which is why when you look at what goes on in Congress, it's one of those things where if you asked every member of Congress, do you think our present immigration policy is wise and makes sense, they would all check no. And then would you say, okay, here's five things we could do. You won't get a majority for any of the five things.
Hmm.
So it's hard. It's politically hard. And it's unfortunate, and we're going to have to deal with it. because we have 13 million people who are here without, not legally, and we're not going to send them all home. So at some point we'll deal with it.
Does moving up the age that we begin Social Security benefits, I mean, how much extra time could that buy us of solvency?
Well, the age is now slowly rising till 67. Raising the age of which you get full benefits helps bring Social Security under control. And if one of the advantages it has is that when they usually talk about that, they're talking about it far in the future. So some 40-year-old will be told you can't retire at 67, you have to work till 68 or 69. And that has two things. One is they don't care because they don't ever think that far in advance. And secondly, to the extent that they do think, they can plan on it. We can't fix the entire Social Security problem by doing that, but my guess is that when we finally get around to a Social Security compromise, it'll involve raising the retirement age for full benefits. It'll involve changing the formula by which benefits are paid so that the benefits are slightly less generous than they are now, particularly for upper-income people. And it'll involve some way increasing the payroll tax on somebody. One of the things about Social Security that's both encouraging and frustrating is there's a menu of clearly thought-out options that if Congress wanted to pick from column A, column B, and column C, they could fix it tomorrow. But there's not the political will to do that. Healthcare is much harder because there isn't that clear set of options that we know how they'd work.
How much of a drain on Social Security are people who receive benefits who are survivors of a worker who has died or who have been disabled?
Well, a drain is a bit of a strong thing. Social Security was set up, or as it's evolved, to take care of retirees, to take care of survivors of people who died, and to take care of the disabled. And a good chunk, I think it's about a third of the recipients now, are not retirees, but people who qualify on those other things. One of the great ironies is Paul Ryan, the Wisconsin Republican, who's very aggressive on cutting spending. His father died, unfortunately, when he was young, and he was a beneficiary of Social Security survivor benefits. It doesn't mean it's not a question of whether we have to continue doing that or whether we can fix it without doing it. It's just it's one of the misunderstandings about Social Security. It's not only a pension program. It's a kind of social insurance that protects your family if you die or protects you if you get disabled. So it makes it harder to fix because people don't understand how it actually works.
Is it reasonable to say that on a lot of entitlement programs, people are sort of comfortable with the idea that they might receive benefits, but concerned that other people are riding the system in some way?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, Doug Elmendorf, who's an economist who runs the Congressional Budget Office, kind of one of the only institutions in Washington that actually works the way it's supposed to, he summed up the entire federal deficit in a single sentence. The American people want more in benefits, primarily for the elderly, than they're willing to send to Washington in taxes. And that tension is really underlies a lot of the difficulties we have with the deficit. There are a lot of people who are on Medicare and Social Security who tell pollsters they're not receiving any they're not a recipient of any government program. Well, that's simply not true. And so that misunderstanding, I think, has poisoned the politics of deficit reduction.
David Wessel is my guest. He's economics editor for the Wall Street Journal and author of the new book, Red Ink, Inside the High-Stakes Politics of the Federal Budget. We'll come back to the conversation in a moment. If you've got a question, you're welcome to join us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is David Wessel. He's economics editor for The Wall Street Journal and author of the new book, Red Ink, Inside the High-Stakes Politics of the Federal Budget. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. David, you mentioned before the break the Congressional Budget Office being one government agency that actually operates the way it is intended to. Talk about how we came to have one at all at the end of the Nixon administration.
Yeah, well, it's Richard Nixon's fault or doing. Richard Nixon had accumulated a lot of power as president and had damaged the credibility of the White House quite a bit. And Congress in 1974 wanted to take more control back of the budget. You know, it originally had been almost exclusively of a congressional operation, beginning with Roosevelt, it became more and more of a White House operation. So they set up this agency. It was unusual, and there was a great deal of disagreement within the Congress about what it was going to be and what kind of person should direct it. Some people thought of it as a kind of bean counter that would just add up the costs, and other people thought it would provide advice. And basically, the second crowd won. The first director was a woman named Alice Rivlin, who's still around and still quite active in the debates about budgets and deficits. And she established it as a kind of unusually credible and intellectually independent agency. And what's interesting to me is that both Democrats and Republicans over the years have seen the value in having someone who you can trust to tell you the truth, at least as they see it, and have protected it from repeated assaults to curtail its independence or to get it to say something it doesn't believe.
So what are the specific powers and responsibilities of the CBO?
It's basically the scorekeeper. When someone puts a bill before the Congress that would spend money or raise taxes or cut spending or cut taxes, CBO decides what the official price tag is on it. And they also make very important estimates of, for instance, on the Obama health care bill, what's that going to cost, how many people are going to be covered, how many more people will be on Medicaid. So they're the ones that give Congress the information they need to, so they can figure out how much money they're actually spending. And a lot of times people propose bills in Congress and they say, this is going to cost $100 million, and I found this way to pay for it that costs $100 million. CBO judges whether both of those numbers are accurate.
So you still had throughout the 70s the federal budget creeping up and up and up. And in the Reagan era, there was this thing nicknamed the starve the beast strategy. And the idea was that if we cut taxes, there's no choice but to decrease spending.
That's right. So there are some people who believe that we'd be better off if we had a smaller government. They were frustrated about the fact that it's hard to convince politicians to spend less money. So they said, well, what if we cut their allowance? That was a phrase that Reagan actually used. It doesn't work. History suggests it doesn't work. We cut the allowance. We reduced taxes. Spending went up, and deficits resulted. That's why Reagan eventually had to raise taxes. And we had a surplus in the Clinton years, in part because he increased the allowance, but partly because spending fell as the end of the Cold War saved us a lot of money on military spending. So it seems to me that recent history suggests that starve the beast doesn't work. It creates big deficits. It then leads to either huge debt or it leads to tax increases. And so the people who came up with that strategy have, at least for the past 30 years, been proven wrong.
Why didn't the pay-as-you-go rule that was sort of decided upon in the middle of the George H.W. Bush administration last and work and keep us in line?
It did work for a time. But the pay-as-you-go, for instance, there was no major expansion of benefit programs. There were no major tax cuts during that period. But it has two problems. One is, as we discussed earlier, the benefit programs like Medicare and Medicaid, if you don't do anything, they grow and grow and grow. Pay-as-you-go said you can't expand them without paying for it, but it also said you don't have to do anything about it if they just grow because more old people or healthcare costs go up. The second thing that happened is we got lulled into a false sense of security when we had big budget surpluses at the end of the Clinton administration. And so it seemed kind of like we don't need to worry about that anymore. And that led to the big tax cuts that President Bush pushed in 2001 and 2003, and more importantly, perhaps the, or at least equally as important, I should say, the Medicare prescription drug benefit, which was probably a good idea. I mean, healthcare is much more based on medicine now than when Medicare was invented, but they weren't forced to find any way to pay for it. And Republicans and Democrats basically gave this new benefit with no visible means of support. And over time, because it's permanent, it'll cost more than the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, because they'll end someday.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Bill in Fort Worth. Hi, Bill.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
I had a question about Social Security and maintaining it as sacrosanct, in other words, not borrowing from it, if it could maintain its fidelity in that case. And another question, in terms of people on both sides, primarily conservatives, saying that we are passing on debt to our children and grandchildren, I was wondering, with watching the cycles throughout the administrations of deficit, surplus, and deficit in the Bush and the Reagan-Bush, Clinton-Bush, respective administrations, if that is ever true. In other words, is right. there really a deficit that lasts past a full generation, 25 years?
Right. Okay, so the first question on Social Security. So for a time, Social Security collected more in taxes than it paid in benefits. It took that money and it used it to invest in the world's safest securities, U.S. Treasury securities. That was lending to the rest of the federal government. That's absolutely true. The deficit would have been bigger if not for the Social Security surplus had been invested and spent by the rest of the government. That day is over. Social Security benefits now exceed the taxes coming in. There's still a lot of money in the Social Security Trust Fund, and some of it's accumulated interest in the past and stuff like that. But Social Security is no longer, if you look just at benefits and taxes, creating a surplus that the rest of the government spend, it's a negative. And the negative will get bigger as more and more baby boomers age. The accounting here is confusing and sometimes misleading, but the simple fact is, in my opinion, you look at the budget as the government as one big hole, W-H-O-L-E, and you mush it all together, and you don't worry about the trust fund, and you get a much clearer idea of how things really work. The second question was, first of all, we haven't had a whole lot of surpluses over time. You know, the only really significant surpluses we've had in the last couple of decades have been those at the end of the Clinton administration, and those evaporated with the weak economy and the wars and tax cuts and Medicare prescription benefits. He's right that in the sense that we don't ever have to pay off the federal debt. We could keep rolling it over. It's not like a car loan where you got to pay it off because someday the car won't be worth anything anymore. But it's probably not true that we can keep increasing the debt at the rate we're doing it and still be able to do that. So in that sense, we are bequeathing our children debt. The second thing is, every year we borrow more money, interest as a share of the federal budget goes up and up and up. And that means that people are paying taxes 20 years from now. More of their taxes will go to pay bondholders, some of them Chinese, and less of that money will be available for whatever else we might want to spend it on. So in that sense, also, we are passing something on to the next generation.
And the amount we're spending now per dollar of federal expenditures on debt service, on interest, is something like 14 cents on the dollar. Is that right?
Right. We borrow about 36 cents of every dollar we spend. And you're right. We're spending about that's a slice that size of the federal, about 15% of the federal budget is going to interest. And that's important because interest rates are really low now. So as interest rates go up, as they return to normal, as they will someday, even if we don't borrow a lot more, we're going to spend more and more of the budget on interest.
So there was some momentum in the second term of the Clinton administration toward a deal with House Speaker Gingrich that might have fixed Social Security or made it stronger moving forward.
Right.
What happened?
Monica Lewinsky happened. You know, the government was enjoying a surplus then, and the surplus makes it much easier to fix something like Social Security because you can use some of that money to help make the medicine go down. But at the end of the Clinton administration, there was the scandal with Monica Lewinsky, the intern, with whom President Clinton had, you know, a sexual relationship. He needed the House Liberal House Democrats to defend him against impeachment. The Republicans had turned against him on everything. That basically crowded out any hope of a compromise on Social Security. Then George W. Bush is elected, and he, instead of fixing Social Security, decides to use the surplus to cut taxes, and we're not much closer to fixing it now than we were the day Clinton left office.
So, David, let's talk about defense spending. I think most Americans are aware that we spend more on national defense than any other country. Many Americans would say that's appropriate. The amount we are spending as compared with many of the next countries in line, I think, might take people by surprise.
Right. So we spend about $700 billion a year on defense right now. And that's more than the combined military budgets of China, Britain, France, Russia, Japan, Saudi Arabia, Germany, India, Italy, Brazil, South Korea, Australia, Canada, Turkey, the United Arab Emirates, Spain, and Israel. Our defense budget is bigger than the combined defense budgets of the next 17 countries. Now, about one of every $5 that the federal government spent last year went to defense. About 20% of that went to the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, which will end someday. But that's a big chunk of money, and I think there's going to be a lot of questioning over the next couple of years about whether we can afford that. It's interesting to me that Mitt Romney is campaigning on increasing defense spending, and President Obama has a new ad out which attacks him for that. And the reason I find that interesting is that the Obama campaign must have polls and focus groups that lead them to believe that more spending on defense is not particularly popular with the voters, even though people do worry about the security of the country.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next on the phone with James in Fort Worth. Hey, James.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to ask your guest, so there's a lot of complaints in the country about people taking advantage of the welfare system or Medicaid. The money that we put to those programs is government spending. People want to, like Tea Party, people want to cut spending. But aren't tax breaks that we give to certain segments of the population, aren't those, I mean, isn't that spending too? And given the sequester that's going on right now and how that may impact other governmental programs like that we just mentioned, and the need to balance it, it seems like some conservative folks have made the weather, and now they're saying it's raining, and because of that we have to cut those programs, but are really dug in on the fact of giving back some of the gifts that they were given.
Well, I kind of agree on the second point. There's a whole lot of people who are a little hypocritical on the deficit. They're not all Republicans. People who are shocked that if you vote for cut taxes and raise spending that you'll have a deficit, and then their solution doesn't meet the size of the problem that they created. So that's definitely true. On the first question, the federal tax system brings in about $1.3 trillion a year, and there are about $1.1 trillion worth of loopholes, credits, deductions, and special breaks. So it is a huge problem. What happened is that it became attractive in Washington if you wanted to do something, and you had a choice. Should I spend $1,000 on it, or should I give somebody a tax credit of $1,000 and tell them to do it? Well, one of them is seen as evil, raising spending, and one of them is seen as good, cutting taxes. So more and more of the spending was run through the tax code. And so we do have a lot of social spending and pro-business, various business, pro-manufacturing, business tax credits and stuff, it's actually a form of spending, but it goes through the tax code, and it makes the tax code really messy and complicated, and it means that we have to have higher tax rates than we would otherwise need to raise the same amount of money. My guess is that any significant change on the deficit, any significant change in taxes, will involve doing away with some of these tax breaks instead of raising tax rates for that reason.
Yeah, so as you say, the federal government gives up almost as much money from tax loopholes, deductions, credits, and other breaks as it collects in individual and corporate income tax. Could the solution be as simple as closing every loophole, or is that even possible given the structure of the tax code as it exists right
now? We could close every loophole if you didn't want to ever leave your office and run for re-election. My loophole is what I call a loophole, you call as necessary government spending.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, we could stop letting people deduct the interest on their mortgages, or we could stop letting companies deduct the interest they pay on their debt. That would mean that they'd have to pay a lot more taxes, but I don't think that's going to happen. So the question is, Mitt Romney, for instance, says that he wants to do away with a lot of deductions and credits and use that money not to reduce the deficit but to lower tax rates. So that would make for a cleaner tax code, but it wasn't do much for reducing the deficit unless it somehow unleashed some magic of economic growth. Other people say we ought to do this because it's the right thing to do, and along the way we can raise more money for the government by doing away with some of these loopholes, deductions, and credits, and do less harm to the economy than if we raise tax rates. And that's pretty much what the Obama people would do.
So even those who are very critical of Governor Romney's relatively low expenditure on taxes, nobody can find that he's doing anything illegal, and a lot of his income comes from capital gains. And so there's been discussion lately about perhaps taxing capital gains at a higher rate than it's now taxed, even if it is lower than the income tax rate.
That's right. So today, if you sell a share of stock, the maximum tax rate on the profits of that is 15%. Whereas if you work and you're a high-paid worker, you could pay as much as 35% on your wages. That's a pretty big differential. And the argument for it is we need to encourage people to save and invest, and lower capital gains taxes produce more investment and a better economy. But I think it's always interesting to remember that the sainted Tax Reform Act of 1986, which everybody involved in taxes thinks was, you know, the only time tax reform ever really did what it was supposed to, Ronald Reagan signed it into law, and that eliminated the tax break for capital gains. It made both income and capital gains taxed at a rate of maximum of 28%. So this is a debate we'll have over and over again, and I think it'll be particularly ripe in the next Congress.
David Wessel is with us. He's economics editor for the Wall Street Journal and author of the new book, Red Ink, Inside the High Stakes Politics of the Federal Budget. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling in to 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Wall Street Journal economics editor David Wessel. His new book is called Red Ink, Inside the High Stakes Politics of the Federal Budget. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or think@kera.org. David, entitlement programs entirely aside, there are people who say we just have too many people on the federal payroll earning salaries for government jobs. What would happen if we greatly reduce the number of people who work for the federal government?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question. If we fired every federal employee from the groundskeepers at the White House to the people who man the radar defenses in Alaska to make sure we don't get bombed by a missile by mistake, if we got rid of all of them, we'd save a lot of money, about $435 billion last year. That would have reduced the deficit by about a third. It's a way of illustrating that most of the money that the government spends doesn't go to government employees. It goes in one funnel at the government, and it goes out in the form of benefits or contracts to people out there in the rest of the country, which is why it's so hard to reduce the deficit.
If tomorrow we reduce the deficit, therefore affecting the gross domestic product of the United States based on all that, so much less spending, would it hurt our economy instantly?
Instantly is a little strong, but I think it would probably hurt. We have a very weak economy now. We're not growing fast enough to bring down unemployment. The point is not, in my view, to try and do massive Greek or Spanish-style austerity. Mm-hmm. The point is to do what we need now to help our economy grow faster now, but to put in a place, a credible plan, that over the next 5 to 10 years will reduce spending and, if necessary, raise taxes to bring down our deficit. So one of the reasons people worry so much about going over the fiscal cliff at the end of the year, these automatic spending cuts and tax increases that will be triggered on December 31st if Congress doesn't do something else to reduce the deficit, is that that would be like taking a person who's sick and saying, you're sick, you're overweight, no more food. It's going to hurt. Mm-hmm. When what you really need to say is you might need a little extra nutrition now, but after you get healthy again, you got to exercise, you got to stop smoking, and you got to stop eating so many potato chips and fried foods. And we need to, that's what makes this so hard. We need what sometimes called a two-fisted fiscal policy, one that does what's useful now to help the economy, but at the same time does what's necessary to restrain future spending and raise taxes if necessary to make the future economy stronger.
Thinking hard about the future is really hard when you're a lawmaker thinking hard about what happens in 2 years.
Yep. I mean, but we did it in the past, you know. What is it about our current elected representatives that they seem to look at everything through the eyes of the next election? I mean, why is it that in the past we've had people who were either so secure in their jobs that they were willing to do what they thought was right, or basically said, I'm going to do what I think is right, even if it's going to cost me my reelection? I mean, the first President Bush, in a way, did that. He raised taxes because he thought it was necessary, and he probably contributed to his own defeat to Bill Clinton. What concerns me is that all of us who cover Washington know there's some members of Congress who are smart and really want to do the right thing, and there's some members of Congress who are not very smart and seem to be completely corrupt, if not in the legal sense, at least in the conventional sense of the word.
Mm-hmm.
What I worry about is how many of that first set, the thoughtful ones, are throwing up their hands and saying, I'm not running for re-election. This place doesn't work anymore. That is a really troubling sign. That's like having your kids in school and having the good teachers quit and the bad ones stay. And that really is an alarming thing that I think people should worry about.
We've got an email here, and the question is, Treasury could cancel all federal debts simply by printing more money with the undesirable side effect of the loss of currency value. Do you think our current predicament is symptomatic of an ongoing policy of global currency leveraging?
Well, first of all, the Treasury can't actually print money. That's the province of the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve could print a lot of money, but I don't think anybody wants to have a system where we just kind of finance all our debts by printing money and pretend that we're not hurting people by having a lot of inflation. So, no, I don't think that's a problem. I don't think it's a solution. The somewhere buried in this question, though, is something which I do think is relevant. That is, for a time, we as a nation live beyond our means by borrowing. It's particularly true for consumers. Wages didn't go up. The value of a house went up. So you borrowed against the value of your house in order to maintain your standard of living, get the things you wanted. Then the value of your house went down, and you were stuck. You owed all this money, but you no longer had the asset on which you would pledge for collateral. So we did overborrow. That's why we had the financial crisis in 2008 and 2009. And it's hard for people to understand that the right response to that in the short term was for the government to borrow more in order to prevent us from having another Great Depression. But now we're at the point where we need to think about how do we start putting ourselves on a sounder trajectory so that in the future we don't get back into that predicament where we've overborrowed.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Elizabeth on the line in Flower Mound. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi. My question was, it's sort of related to the last one, which is, what does your guest know about, or could he comment on modern monetary theory? And I also wondered if he could also comment on the risk of hyperinflation when we've had basically a humongous increase in spending over the last 3 or 4 years since the crash, and we haven't seen that kind of inflation that everyone has been so afraid of. That was about it.
Well, the caller probably doesn't know the book I did before was called In Fed We Trust, which is a book about how the Fed responded to the financial crisis in 2008 and 2009. So let me answer the second question first. Yes, it is possible if the Fed creates a lot of money and the federal government is profligate and we get to full employment and the federal government keeps spending heavily that we will create more inflation. But we are so far from that problem now that I frankly don't lose much sleep about it. I think Ben Bernanke, the Fed chairman, would be happier if the economy was in such good shape that his only problem was that prices were going up faster than his 2% target. But they're not. I think that hyperinflation, which means kind of what we saw in Zimbabwe or 1920s Germany, requires irresponsible central banks. I don't see any evidence that our central banks are anywhere close to irresponsible. Modern monetary theory is a bit kind of a vague thing. I think basically, I mean, the Fed's going to make a decision, announce a decision pretty soon now. Basically, the Federal Reserve has done a lot in order to maintain the economy close to its goal of the lowest possible unemployment with stable prices. The problem is it hasn't worked, and they have to decide now whether they should do more, or would doing more cause so much worry about inflation, among other things, that it would be better if they did nothing. And we'll find out in about half an hour what they decided this meeting.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next on the phone with Bart in Dallas. Hey, Bart.
Hey, my comments are actually a request of comments, because it's the following. I'm correct, I think it was yesterday, that they were talking about increasing the minimum wages. And a company like Walmart and others were fighting that because it would cost jobs. I see two things. The first one is, I remember, I think it was Henry Ford who said, I need to pay my workers enough so I can afford, they can afford my cars and I can afford to sell them. I see all around the companies cutting the wages as much as they can and then complaining in the consumption of expenditure that people don't spend. And at the same time, I'm thinking those same companies who complain that they're going to cut jobs are the ones who are cutting jobs. And if they really have jobs to cut, that would have been done already. Otherwise, they would have complained of their shareholders.
I had trouble hearing the question.
If there was one in there,
can you rephrase it?
The line wasn't great. I think Bart's question was about talk of changing the minimum wage and whether or not increasing the minimum wage would cost jobs, if I have that correct.
Well, there's a big argument about that among economists. Generally, people think that when you raise wages, that some companies will decide it's not worth it to hire an extra worker. There's some evidence, some of it done by Alan Krueger, who's now one of President Obama's economic advisors, that small increases in the minimum wage, particularly at certain times in the economy, don't have that effect. I think right now we have lots of unemployment, so you do have to worry about whether an increase in the minimum wage would discourage employment. But we also know that the minimum wage has been eroded so much by the value by inflation that there are a lot of jobs that lower level jobs that people are paying more than a minimum wage. So that suggests that the minimum wage has become almost irrelevant to the market, that employers have to pay more than that to get workers, in which case an increase wouldn't do much harm. I haven't studied it lately, and I don't think I'm the right guy to resolve the difference, but there is a problem in our society when people work full time and they can't make ends meet. One way to do that is the minimum wage. Address that. Another way is this tax credit I talked about, the earned income tax credit, which gives low-wage workers a cash bonus for working. And then that's one of the things that it gets attacked because it takes those people off the income tax rolls and people say, oh, they're not paying their fair share. So there's some big issues there, and they're not easy to resolve.
Since the recession, David, we have heard that a lot of consumers are paying down their individual credit card debt. I think I heard the other day that the number has come down like 16% since 2008. Of course, that also assumes that there is less consumer spending going on. Are consumers who are trying to get their own financial houses in order ultimately damaging the economy?
Well, they're definitely spending less, and if they spent more, the economy would be better. But it doesn't mean that, first of all, some of them don't have any choice.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of those people who've reduced their debts have done it by walking away from them because they couldn't afford to pay them. A lot of that's not just, you know, people paying a little more off their credit card. It's defaulting on them. But one of the reasons the economy is so slow is we borrowed too much in the recent past, particularly consumers. We need to reach a point where people's debt relative to their income comes down to the point where they feel comfortable to spend a lot. It's called deleveraging. And one of the lessons of economic history is when everybody does what's in their own personal self-interest at the same time, it can hurt the economy as a whole. So the case for the government borrowing and spending more during this period is precisely to offset the contractionary effect of that attempts of consumers to pay down their loans. And that's, it would have been, it, yes, it's hurting consumer spending. Yes, it's probably necessary. And yes, that's why the government's increase in deficits under Obama, in part, was justified in order to offset the bad effects from that.
Given the size and the state of the federal deficit today, David, you were adamant that sort of nickel and dime changes are not going to be sufficient to fix the federal government's fiscal problems. Are there any strategies at this point that, that people on both sides of the aisle agree might be effective and appropriate?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I think that some of the nickel and dime stuff that gets a lot of press, the wasteful spending, is important to cut because it gives people trust, give people more trust in the Congress when they want to do other things that are painful. I think that the best thing we can do, I think there is some agreement that we need some kind of tax reform which lowers tax rates and does away with some of the loopholes, deductions, and credits. And that might help the economy, and it might be a way to raise some revenue, which would help reduce the deficit. I think there needs to be, there is some agreement, not universal agreement, but there's certainly a lot more scrutiny of the defense budget than we've seen in some time, and that's going to be part of it. And there is widespread agreement, if you listen to people, on some of the nature of the problem, which is we got to do something about healthcare cost growth. Most of the people who think about this realize that's important. Where they disagree on is what is the right recipe. But, you know, it makes it easier when you agree on things that are, on what the causes of the problem. That makes it easier to solve than when you're disagreeing on what the causes are. Although there's plenty of that, too, I'm afraid.
You have really an exceptional ability to take very complex subjects and make them digestible to average readers. This book is comes in at like 150 pages. I wonder if you can talk just briefly about the process of taking something that is big and complicated and divining it down so that people who are not experts in finance and in government policy can understand.
Well, first of all, thank you. Look, everybody who is a successful journalist is good at something, but we're not all good at the same things. I have colleagues who can write incredibly beautiful and moving soldiers about soldiers getting killed and their families. And I have other colleagues who are incredibly good at ferreting out just what it is that's going on, getting people to tell them things that they don't want the public to know. But over time in covering the economy, I have discovered that I enjoy and there's an appetite for people to kind of explain this to me. And if I'm good at it, it's because I had the luxury of working for a newspaper that permitted me to write stories that didn't make news but explain things. That's the column I do every week. And frankly, public radio has helped me a lot. I do a lot of Morning Edition, and when someone tells you, we want to talk about this issue, and you have 3 minutes and 45 seconds, it does help you say, okay, what is it that people really need to know? And I learn a lot when people ask me questions and I try and explain it to them, particularly if you're doing it face-to-face, and you can tell when you're getting through or not getting through.
And I'm afraid I have to jump in here because we've run out of time. David Wessel's new book is called Red Ink, Inside the High-Stakes Politics of the Federal Budget. David, thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell makes the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. If you want to download the podcast, it's available for free at kera.org/think. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.